NBA All-Star 2019 coverage from Charlotte continues here on Warrior Sound, and it's a Saturday night tradition here at All-Star Weekends to hear from NBA Commissioner Adam Silver, who gives a State of the Union address. And here's what we heard tonight from Commissioner Silver.
Originally, we were scheduled to play the All-Star game in Charlotte in 2017. After that announcement, a law was passed in North Carolina called HB2, which, in the view of the league office and many others, discriminated against the LGBTQ community. And we then made a decision that it was inconsistent with the values of this league to play the All-Star game here under those circumstances. It was not an economic boycott of North Carolina. Of course, the Charlotte Hornets continued to play here. 29 other NBA teams continued to travel to North Carolina to play. We have a G League team in Greensboro, but we felt that in terms of celebratory environment, as we have with our All-Star events, it was not appropriate. I would say then, with strong support from Michael Jordan and Fred Whitfield and others in the organization, they began an effort working with the city and the state to repeal that law. And ultimately, I'd say in true North Carolina fashion, people came together and ultimately did change that law. It, for many people, didn't go far enough, and I am sympathetic to those who feel that there still are not appropriate protections for the LGBTQ community. But I also felt from a league standpoint that it was important, in, as part of our core values, to work with people and ultimately to move forward with the community. And with the strong encouragement of Governor Roy Cooper, who has been a fantastic partner to us in these All-Star efforts, and with Mayor Lyles, who we spent significant time with over the last few days, we all came together, you know, as a league, and are now here, you know, celebrating All-Star in North Carolina. I'd say it's also another example when you look back over the history of sports and in the NBA, where we see the opportunity to use sports to bring people together and focus on important societal issues. It's interesting, I went to college here in North Carolina at Duke University, and I know a little bit about the history of basketball in this state, and something that some people may not be aware of, but the first integrated college basketball game in the United States, or the, certainly the first integrated basketball game that any of us are aware of, took place in Durham in 1944. And that was 6 years even before the integration of the NBA. And I think just as we've seen tremendous progress when it comes to race, of course, just look no further than who the owner of this team is right now. We've also seen progress when it comes to bringing people of various nationalities together in this league, to the point now where 25% of this league is comprised of players who are born outside of the United States. And I can't think of a single instance as I travel around this league where fans are any less devoted to the team because a particular player, you know, on that squad was born outside the United States. I mean, they have, there's seemingly complete separation when it comes to competition on the floor. I think another area where there's been enormous progress in sports is now around issues of gender. And I think now in the league, you know, that's been a real focus of ours, where we have more women who are serving as officials, more women who are working in a capacity as scouts or assistant coaches, and in the front office. And I think there's an opportunity, once again, when it comes to the issue of gender identity, for the league to play a role in bringing people together and demonstrating through our own actions why principles like tolerance, inclusion, and equality, are critically important to how we operate as a sport and how we should live as a society. And again, I don't think this is something unique just to basketball or the NBA. We've seen those principles operating in sports in the United States certainly for decades, and I'm proud to continue that tradition. Lastly, let me just say that these All-Star festivities are a true highlight for us. In terms of legends, we have roughly 150 former players who've chosen to come to this community and work with us, whether it's clinics, community service events, activities in the arena. They're just former players who want to be part of these activities. I don't know the precise number, but we have certainly multiple current NBA players who've chosen to be here during their break, not because they are All-Stars or competing in All-Star Saturday Night events, but because they want to be part of the celebration of the game. And we conducted a community service day on Friday where we had 1,500 of our guests work on community projects, whether it's packing lunches and meals for people in need in the community, working on refurbishing basketball courts, working on reconstructing homes. And that's become a core part of the All-Star festivities for many of our guests. And, you know, lastly, the estimate, the most recent estimate I've heard is that 150,000 people have come to Charlotte to be part of these All-Star activities, and so it's fantastic for the community. And the governor and the mayor have told me that the current estimate is that the economic impact of bringing All-Star to North Carolina will be roughly $100 million. So I think it's just all of those things. It's wonderful that that all can come together around a celebration of the game. So with that, Tim, happy to answer any questions.
All right, we'll start in the third row here with Tim.
Hey, Adam. Tim Reynolds of the Associated Press. You've been asked a lot in recent years about competitive balance, small market versus big market, things of that nature. Obviously, there's still a lot of season left, but Milwaukee has the best record in the league. Denver is right there contending for the West. Sacramento's in a position to get in for the first time in a very long time, for 13 years, I think. Are these signs that competitive balance that you've talked about, that you've wanted, are these just further signs that it's happening, or do you still want to see more growth in that area?
It's a good question, Tim. I'm always weary in this day and age of data and analytics to use too many anecdotes to create greater points. And certainly, you can point to teams like Milwaukee, teams like Oklahoma City, what's happening in Denver now and Sacramento, as signs that the system is working better than it has historically. I'd say we still have work to do, though. I think it, in this day and age, has less to do with small market versus big market. In some cases, it has to do with payrolls. In our cap system, as you well know, it's a tax-based system, which creates penalties, in essence, for going over the salary cap, but you still end up with fairly large disparities in salaries, you know, from one market to another. And often that disparity is not based on the size of the market. In certain cases, it's based on revenue generation, which doesn't always perfectly correlate. In some cases, it's based on a willingness of a team to become unprofitable. And so those factors concern me a little bit, you know, in that I think there's still work to be done to create a system where you can create, in essence, more parity of opportunity. I mean, I don't think success necessarily means that a different team wins the championship every year. I mean, I look at the NFL, which among sports leagues probably has the best parity and the best system in terms of creating competition than any league I'm familiar with. Yet, the New England Patriots have been in the Super Bowl 9 out of the last 18 years. And I don't think anyone points to that as a sign that the system isn't necessarily working. I think what people recognize is you want, you know, parity of opportunity, but you don't want to artificially create competition that somehow takes away incentives for teams to be great. So I think in the case of the NBA, I'm pleased with what I'm seeing, but I know, and certainly many of the people in this room have written about issues that remain in the league, that you still find situations where teams seem to be uncompetitive, maybe either by choice because they think they're better off rebuilding and seeking high draft picks, or they feel that they can't afford, based on other teams being high into the tax, to compete on a level playing field. So I, from where we came historically as a league, remember, this is a league where if you look at the last I think 11 years, we've had seven different teams win championships. But if you look back to the first 60 years of this league, I think three teams won. The Lakers, the Celtics, and the Bulls won 60% of all championships. So progress, you know, but and I think the issues are fixable. And ultimately, I think the players and their association have the exact same interest as the league does in creating as competitive a system as possible. I mean, think about it. Now, players shouldn't have an interest in some teams having a competitive advantage over others. So I think as we have a terrific relationship with the Players Association now. We have many years to go before we sit back down at the table for collective bargaining. But I strongly believe that as sophisticated people who are increasingly sophisticated get involved in this game and study these systems, incredible people working both at the Players Association and our teams, that we can still come up with yet a better system to create more competition.
Right here in front of me, Steve.
Steve Goldberg, FIBA.basketball. Concurrent with the All-Star festivities is the fifth global Basketball Without Borders camp. And on the opening night of the league this year, there were 27 players who were alumni of that camp. Could you speak to the importance of that in the development of the NBA and the international game?
I can. And for the league, there's nothing more important than continuing to develop that next generation of players. And I think if you look back at the league historically, we played more of a passive role, I think, when it came to development of players, whether it was through college system or systems that existed in Europe or other parts of the world. Those players were, in essence, presented to us when they were ready for the draft. I think we're increasingly of the view that we can have more direct involvement in the development of players. And once again, I think it's from learning and learning from other sports internationally, particularly soccer, that where players grow up in an academy system and they are developed as professionals at a younger age, recognized as potentially, you know, great players. I mean, that's a large pool. Certainly they don't all become, you know, the professionals or top level professionals, but with the Basketball Without Borders camps, or with the academies that we've opened now in Africa, India, and China, the notion is that we can play a much more direct role in the development of players. And if we get to them, boys and girls, at a younger age, we can begin teaching them not just fundamentals, but the values of this game, helping build character around the game, teaching them about their bodies, teaching them the importance of nutrition and sleep and stretching and physical fitness. And we're seeing success with that. You know, certainly you point to the number of players in this league who've come through Basketball Without Borders. We're already seeing some early success with our academy in Africa. I mean, and I have this conversation with ministers of sport in countries around the world. I mean, sometimes there's this notion that when's the next great player coming, as opposed to when are we going to develop the next great player? And just related to your question, I think it's wonderful what we're seeing in the league right now. Some of the rules changes that we've made in the last few years that really focus on skill-based playing. I like to think that young people around the world are able to look at this game and say, I can be as great as my desire to dedicate myself to this game, that especially when it comes to shooting and ball handling. I get it, you can't dream about being 7 feet tall, but you can dream about having ball handling skills like Steph Curry.
Second row on the right, Rick.
Hey, Adam, Rick Bonnell with the Charlotte Observer. You've had two recent tampering situations. And in addition to that, you recently fined a prominent player for comments made by his agent. Do you feel like you're in the right place as a league as far as respecting contractual relationships between teams and players? And if not, do you have the sufficient tools to do something that needs to be done?
Again, I try to look at that issue in terms of the historical context of this league. You know, trade demands and tampering are two very different topics. I mean, certainly when it comes to tampering, I believe the league has all the tools needed in order to investigate and potentially prosecute, so to speak, a tampering claim. And I believe that, you know, within our rules, you know, the people at the league office who are in charge of those areas do a terrific job. It's not to say that, you know, there aren't there isn't some conversation that the league office isn't aware of, and I think we draw appropriate lines because nobody who's part of the NBA wants to live in a police state either. And so I think within reason, I think we're doing a good job enforcing our rules. In terms of trade demands, again, certainly that's absolutely nothing new in this league, and I won't name names, but some of the greatest players in the history of this league have demanded trades at various points in their contract. Having said that, no one likes to see an instance where a player is demanding that he be traded when he still is in the middle of a contractual obligation to a team. It's one of the reasons why, in the most recent case, I find the player, even though it wasn't the player, but his agent who demanded that trade. I recognize that there's very little I'm going to do to ever stop that completely. I think this goes back to the earlier question, though, about the system elements. And I think the question is, can we do a better job creating a league in which the competition is fair for all 30 teams? And I do think over time we will do an even better job there. I mean, I will say that, you know, that every situation is a bit unique. And I think that there's a tendency to sort of quickly decide, you know, who's at fault in those situations. And ultimately, as we look at any individual situation as a league office, generally they're a little bit more complex than people might understand. But I would just say blanketly, no, I don't like trade demands, and I wish they didn't come, and I wish that all those matters were handled behind closed doors. But don't forget, even part of it, maybe the league has to take responsibility. When we, in the most recent collective bargaining agreement, the thought was teams should be able to be in a position to extend a year early so that a player didn't reach the end of his contract and that the team was then in a position where they were blindsided and said, well, we had no idea the player wasn't going to stay. And the notion of extending a year early was that you could have that conversation with the player, and the player told you behind closed doors, I'm of course going to honor my contract, but I don't plan on staying at the end of it. The player would be in a position to get value for the player. Once again, you know, the law of unintended consequences, it hasn't worked precisely as we had planned. So yet another area we need to focus on.
Second row on your left, Davide.
Davide Chinellato, NBA Gazzetta dello Sport, Italy. Commissioner, this year you included two legends like Dirk Nowitzki and Dwayne Wade in the All-Star rosters, adding them to the roster. I was wondering if you can take us through the process of making that decision and if you're going to repeat this decision next year or in the coming years.
It's interesting. The suggestion actually came from a fan. In an email to me, I get lots of emails as commissioner, or people can go to our website and in essence email ideas to the commissioner, or often complaints. And in this case, it was an idea that came from a fan, and then I heard it from some others as well. I asked my colleagues in the league office what they thought of it, and then I spoke to both Mark Cuban, of course, the principal owner of the Mavericks, and Mickey and Nick Arison at the Miami Heat, and asked them what they thought of the idea. Everyone thought it was a wonderful idea, not mine. I was really just sharing it with them. And that was the genesis of it. I didn't think about it in terms of the next year or whether there'll be other opportunities. I think that as a league, I like to think we have the flexibility when there are special occasions, and I just to speak directly to those two players, I thought it was a very unique situation in which you had, you know, two NBA champions, two NBA players who had long, fantastic careers, both of whom had been All-Stars multiple times in their career, and both of whom, in the case of Dwayne Wade, had already announced it was going to be his last season. In the case of Dirk Nowitzki, I saw him painfully running up and down the court, and I think it was clear that this was going to be his last season, and it just seemed like a wonderful opportunity to honor two greats without taking away an All-Star spot from a player who otherwise was voted from the fans or named by the coaches. And so that was the entire thought process.
Fourth row in the middle, Dave.
Dave McBrendan, ESPN. Adam, getting back to the trade demand conversation, I mean, with the proliferation of, you know, player speculation creating the sport into a 12-month-a-year conversation, and that seemingly only growing to help the business, and also the flip side of players like Blake Griffin or DeMar DeRozan being traded when they seemingly were in a very stable franchise situation. Is there necessarily a problem, and is there a role that the league should take, or is that overstepping its boundaries?
Well, in terms of the role the league should take, I mean, I don't want to do something extraordinary in that I'm reaching to some broad power to interfere with the workings of the collective bargaining agreement. I mean, I think those are issues that should be discussed at the table in terms of how the system should work. I think you raise a fair point in terms of it's two-sided. Of course, teams also blindside players too and trade them. I think the issue ultimately is that it's whether it be a team or a player, not meeting a contractual obligation. I mean, that's something I think you just don't want to see as a league, even if it's whether it's a 1-year contract or a 5-year contract. That's a commitment a player makes, and it's a commitment that the organization makes to that player with a guaranteed contract. I recognize, and I think it's perfectly appropriate, that conversations take place behind closed doors where players or their agents are saying to management, it's my intention to move on for whatever reasons. I think when they make a public spectacle of it, I hear you in terms of the enormous media interest that comes from it, but that's not the kind of media interest we're looking for. I will say, and it's related to your question, that maybe people have lost sight a little bit of the fact that, again, blame the league or not, but two collective bargaining agreements ago in 2010 and 11, we set out to shorten contracts because we thought we wanted to more closely tie pay to performance, and we wanted to give teams a chance to rebuild faster, meaning players wouldn't be locked into to contractual situations for too long a period, and we also wanted to give players the flexibility to move on. So the result of that is the latest I've heard from our basketball operations group is that I believe 40% of our players are going to be free agents this summer. So it's two sides of the coin. Some people could say, oh my God, look at all that player movement. On the other hand, that player movement can be very positive for a lot of teams. So, while we certainly are becoming a 52-week-a-year sport, and I think that's largely a result of tremendous interest in these players and not just what happens on the floor, but how they choose to live their lives, I think we can do a better job as a league, though, in avoiding those situations where they get to the point where players are either, demanding they be traded or, worst case scenario, saying, I'm not going to honor my contract.
Eighth row on the left. Howard, if you could raise your hand so I could see. Thank you.
Howard Beck with Bleacher Report. Hey, Adam. Asked you in December whether the new lottery odds were having the desired impact. I think, agreed it was probably a little early. We're now about two-thirds of the way through the season. There are four teams that are on pace for 20 wins or fewer. I went back 15 years and then stopped at that point. I could not find another year where there were four teams with 20 wins or fewer, but a couple with three teams with 20 wins or fewer. It just seems that there's still a lot of discussion, fans who still are rooting for their teams to lose, teams that are still, I would say, designed not to necessarily be competing at the highest level. Do you have any sense right now of whether the lottery odds are having the desired impact? And if not, is there anything else you would consider?
Howard, my answer is the same as it was in September to a certain extent. I still think it's a bit early, and let's see what happens, whether certain behavior of teams is rewarded through the lottery. I mean, clearly, in many cases, the odds are not in their favor. I recognize in terms of playing the analytics, it doesn't mean that the strategy is going to be eliminated completely. And as you know, this is the sixth time that we've changed the odds of the draft lottery. And I'm pretty sure we acknowledged at the time that we didn't think we'd solved the problem. And people are familiar with the operation of other leagues. You understand now why there's relegation in European soccer, for example, because you pay an enormous price if you're not competitive. And I think, again, for the league and for our teams, there's that ongoing challenge of whether we can come up with yet a better system. I personally don't think it's a winning system, a winning strategy over the long term to engage in multiple years of rebuilding. I understand genuine rebuilding when you're trading away, for example, or not re-signing a star player who you believe is now in the downward slide of his career, and you think you're better off going young and invariably getting a high draft pick. I think that this issue may be taken play, may be solved to a certain extent in the marketplace of ideas, depending on how this now goes over the next year or two, and seeing what the results are, and seeing what the results are of some of these long-term rebuilding programs. But I'm certainly not here to say we solved the problem. I will say, though, that, well, you point out those four teams. We have many more competitive teams this year than we've had any time in the recent past, of teams that are competing hard, competing for spots in the playoffs, and great competition on the floor. So I think we've made progress, but and we've seen this in other sports as well, that there's a mindset that if you're going to be bad, you might as well be really bad. I believe personally that's corrosive, you know, for those organizations, putting aside my personal view of what the impact it has on the league overall. But again, we'll see how this plays out.
Fifth row in the middle, Mark.
Mark Spears, ESPN's The Undefeated. Can you talk about the impact the Curry family has made on and off the court this weekend? And also, also if you could speak to the settlement that Reed and Kaepernick received.
On Reed and Kaepernick, it's interesting. I mean, I assume those players or their representatives made a decision to keep the settlement confidential. I was a little bit surprised by that, just because there's been so much focus on the issue. So I know no more than anyone sitting in this room about the settlement. I'd say generally, I'm glad if, though usually a settlement suggests that both sides were satisfied with the outcome. So to the extent that the NFL and those two players have reached somewhat of an amicable settlement, I think that's positive for everyone. I'm happy for the NFL, and I'm happy for those players that they're in a position where they can now move on. I don't really have a sense of what that now means for Colin Kaepernick, whether it means that he's going to be playing in the NFL or playing in one of these new upstart leagues. That, again, I have no inside information on that. In terms of the Curry family, I think the impact is yet to be known. Obviously, we'll see what happens. You have two Curry brothers competing in three-point contest tonight. But I'd say, and Steph, of course, in the All-Star game, I'd say up till now, that seemingly there's been a Curry representative at just about every community event I've been to. You know, for people who don't know, of course, you know, Steph Curry grew up in the Charlotte market. Dell, you know, played here. It continues to be a television commentator in this market. I mean, I've known Dell, of course, since he was a player. Incredibly fond of the family. They seem to be the first family of Charlotte, at least this week. And I would say on behalf of the league, we're really appreciative of the entire family's commitment to working with us on, I mean, numerous and countless events in the community. I mean, I just hope the Currys have energy left for the basketball.
We're going to take three more. Fourth row on the left, Ken.
Ken Berger, Bleacher Report. Just a follow-up to Rick's question as well as Dave's. When players make trade demands with an increasingly long horizon to when they'll actually be a free agent, in Anthony Davis's case, almost 18 months away, aside from your objection to that on a contractual basis, is it potentially destructive to the competitive balance of your league? And if you feel it is, how could those small market teams be insulated against the impact of it?
You know, Ken, once again, I'm not so sure it's a small market, big market problem. I mean, I'm not even sure where the line is anymore on big markets. You know, as I've said earlier, I mean, if you look, you know, at the success of the so-called big markets in the last 5 years, they've been an all-time low in terms of their success on the floor. I think last season was the first season on record where, you know, the Lakers, Knicks, and the Bulls didn't make the playoffs. Now, we didn't have a single big, you know, the traditional big market teams even playing in the playoffs. Or if you look back at the records of, you know, the Lakers, you know, the Knicks, the Bulls, you know, over the last 5 years, they've been in the bottom, you know, half of the league, certainly competition on the floor. So then you tell me where you draw the line on big market, small market. And as the question suggested earlier, I think you can have enormous success in a small market, success that we never saw historically in this league. You know, whether a trade, so putting aside big market, small market, whether an early trade demand has an impact on competitive balance,
I'm not sure. I think we got to continue to look at this issue. I mean, one way to look at it is 18 months. To me, it's not exactly how I see it, because I think everyone recognized in the case of the Pelicans that the pivotal time was this summer based on our new system. And either he was going to make a commitment to the organization or they were going to likely trade him. I think the difference is you don't want to see that play out publicly. And here there was a trade demand, and it is. And it creates, understandably, a very awkward position between the team and the player and what the role is of the league in terms of injecting itself in the middle of what a team's decision on playing that player. And these become very context-specific issues for the league office and not subject to, you know, computer programs that spit out answers. But again, back to the earlier, you know, my earlier responses, I don't want to be overly defensive here because I don't want to defend the system as smoothly operating. I believe it's an area where we can do better. It's something we have to sit down with the Players Association, but I ultimately have confidence that, again, these are not endemic problems to the league. These, are to me, are very fixable issues that if you have a Players Association that is sitting down with us and saying, how can we create the best competition, the great best system among 30 teams, we can come up with a better way of proceeding.
Six rows second in. Brad, if you could raise your hand for me.
Brad Townsend, Dallas Morning News. Next week is the one-year mark from when the improprieties surfaced in the Mavericks organization. And I know that you visited the franchise a couple of weeks ago. How would you assess what progress has been made in the last year? And also, where do things stand in Mark Cuban's pledge to donate $10 million to women's organizations?
In terms of Mark Cuban's pledge, Kathy Behrens, our president of social responsibility, has been working closely with Mark and Cynthia Marshall, the president of the team, and I know they're on plan. You know, they are reviewing the organizations, which Mark is making the commitment to. And you know, as you mentioned, I was just in Dallas, and you know, I got a report directly from Cynthia and from Kathy, and so you know, Mark is absolutely, you know, meeting his commitment and has told me he's doing far more beyond that. That is his personal decision and not something he's seeking any publicity around. So I won't talk more about that. In terms of progress at the team, again, I think what was no doubt a horrific situation, I think that there are a lot of positive, if you can say that, or a silver lining has come out of it. And I had the opportunity to speak to virtually every employee of the team through a series of meetings over the course of a full day. I was there, and I spoke to some employees individually, and I spoke to them as a group. And again, we also have hotlines in place, anonymous ways of reporting issues. And at least what was reported directly to me and through the organization is that it was a complete sea change in culture on the business side with the Mavericks, that Cynthia Marshall was getting the highest possible grades, and along with the new senior management team that she had been brought in. I think many employees, longtime employees there, felt somewhat liberated. I think some felt still, honestly, a bit scarred, that they felt everything was being done to address those issues, and they thought systems, most importantly, had been put in place at the Mavericks to ensure that they don't end up ever again in a situation like that. And just add to the silver lining, something I talked about last year, I think it was eye-opening for the league office in terms of us putting in place, you know, league-wide programs to ensure that nothing like that can happen again, but also 29 other teams went back and reassessed everything they were doing, and to the extent they didn't have state-of-the-art programs themselves, have also ensured that they have.
Last question, third person in on the second row.
Josh Martin, Close Up 360. Mr. Commissioner, I think it's fair to say that the NBA is one of the more media-friendly leagues around. This room is sort of a testament to that. What's your perspective now on the growing trend of players using the NBA as a platform to grow, not only in business, but as major players in media and entertainment?
I think it's fantastic that the players have these opportunities. I think, one, it's great for them personally that more business opportunities come from it. But now, maybe speaking more selfishly on behalf of the league, I think what causes fans globally to become even more engaged with these incredible players is when they see them as the truly multidimensional people they are. And you know, while the media plays an incredibly valuable role and complements everything we do, I think whether it's the league teams or the players' ability to speak directly to the fans is also really important. And I think there are situations now where players, where they might not have been as comfortable going through the media or responding to a question, or just want to share aspects of their lives directly with fans. And in some cases, it's social or political issues. In other areas, it's music, it's fashion, it's culture. But I think even for me, as you know, a fan of this sport and others, or a fan of music and other, you know, business leaders in society, I find that when I learn more about them and I find those connections, it makes me more engaged in what they do and make me more interested. And so it's been really positive. And I think it's all brought us together to this whole ecosystem around digital media and business opportunities for our players. And finally, it's made, I think, for the league, it's created better conversations, because I've always said, I mean, it's not just now that having Michael Jordan as a team owner or Grant Hill in Atlanta or David Robinson in San Antonio. I mean, I think that helps give the players a different perspective when they see, okay, well, maybe I actually will be sitting on the other side of the table one day. But even if they're never going to own an NBA team, but they're just a business owner or a small business owner, I think it leads to more healthy conversations when I can sit with a player and say, well, this is how we see it as a business. These are the investments we need to make. This is what a fair return is in terms of investments. This is the risk that owners are taking in building new buildings. I just think it leads to healthier conversations when they also are operating as businessmen themselves.